Well, good morning to everyone. So good to be with you. And once again, I'm honored and privileged to be able to bring a lesson. And I hope it's helpful. Thank you, Jesse, for singing those good creation songs, because I'm going to be talking about that. Psalm 111, verse 2, the works of the Lord are great, studied by all those who have pleasure in them. Put it another way, every Christian should have pleasure in studying the works of the Lord. And the works of the Lord, the most obvious and self-apparent, self-evident work of the Lord is His creation. We are part of it. We see it all around us every day of our lives. And so this morning I want to give you an increased knowledge and confidence in this fact that has been revealed to us in the Scriptures, in Genesis 1 and actually many other places throughout the Scriptures. And that truth is this: that God created all life on earth complete, well-defined from the beginning. There was no incremental process to it. God created everything just as He wanted it from the beginning. There was no long line of misfits to get to what God wanted. God does not need an eraser. I do. I'm an artist, and sometimes I erase things. God doesn't need an eraser. He doesn't make any mistakes. He hasn't made any mistakes in creation. So the specific point that I want to make this morning is that your faith in the account that is given in Genesis 1 and its accuracy regarding the singular, supernatural, one-time, six-day event of creation, that your faith in that is not just a belief that you have. It's not just a faith that you have. But the realities of biology, and we're going to be talking about some particular things here, but the realities that exist in the world actually prove that that is not just a faith, not just a belief. It is actually the only way it can be. There is no other way that it can be. And I'm going to prove that to you. And I'm going to talk a little bit at the end of the lesson about the word proof. I'll get to that in a moment. But the proof of this claim and the declaration of God is evidenced in His creation itself. So the words of the creation match the biological facts and realities of the creatures that He has made on earth. Now, to get more specific still, we're going to be briefly examining four creatures that God created. And if we were in a biology class, these stages of life would be called life cycles. Like this. This is an illustration of one of those creatures that has a very distinct stages of life. Or like this. Or like this. Or like this. Now, we're going to start with a dragonfly. Like that. Or like that. Or like that. All of us have seen dragonflies all of our lives. I grew up part of my life on a lake, and there were dragonflies all over the place all the time. So how do you get one of those? I mean, not how do you catch one. You could probably catch them. You might be able to catch one with a net, but how did they get here? Incidentally, this is free, but the evolutionists tell us that dragonflies are like the oldest thing on earth. that there are fossils of very large dragonflies in the fossil record. There are indeed large dragonflies in the fossil record, and they would say that they're in the neighborhood of 300 million years old. Well, is that true? And how did they get here? And why are they complete from the beginning? We don't see any emerging or evolution of a dragonfly. All we see are dragonflies in the fossil record. This is just one thing that we could talk about. Well, dragonflies have a extremely distinctive two stages to their lives, as the other things that we're going to look at. Most of the dragonfly's life is actually spent in the water, not in the air. We see them in the air, but most of their life is actually in the water. And that water stage is known as the dragonfly nymph. Now, you don't hear the word nymph very often. That's N-Y-M-P-H, nymph. When you think about nymph, you out of this context, you may think of like a fairy-like creature from Greek mythology. But that's kind of like the opposite of dragonfly nymphs. Dragonfly nymphs are kind of scary, actually. They're dangerous. If you happen to be that's one of them right there. If you happen to be a small creature that lives in the water, like a small minnow or a tadpole or a mosquito larva, anything like that, the dragonfly nymph is a predator, a dangerous predator to you if you happen to be one of those creatures. And he's extremely dangerous to you because he has a secret weapon, and almost nobody knows about it. It's not that nobody can learn about it. It's not that it's not known. But as I say before, Christians need to enjoy and appreciate the works of God, and they're studied, and we should be studying them. Now, he snatches his prey into his jaws by an amazing mechanism that's on the front of his, that's actually under his jaws or mandible. And you see here is a photograph of one, and you see those sort of claw-like protrusions coming out from the head. There's an extraordinary engineering mechanism, and this is only one of many unique things about the dragonfly nymph, including jet propulsion. When he wants to get a prey, he can. There's a jet. You know what a jet ski is? It's like that. And then also he has this protrusion with claws that come out extremely so fast that it has been extremely difficult to photograph, even with modern very fast video cameras. And this is just one illustration. If you go on YouTube and look up dragonfly nymph, you can see from some very scary video there of the dragonfly nymph catching a prey and eating it. You'll have nightmares about it. So you probably shouldn't do that. But if you want to, you can. So these are death trap jaws, which are very sophisticated. And the point that I'm making here is they have nothing to do with the dragonfly. The dragonfly, when it becomes a dragonfly, does not have this mechanism at all. It is not a part of the dragonfly. Now, the metamorphosis, what I'm saying is the metamorphosis from one form to another is so complete that they seem to be two completely different animals or creatures. They seem to have no relationship one to the other. Now, why is this important in our premise, the premise that I'm putting forth at this time. Why is this proof of the one-time, well-defined, supernatural creation of God? Why is that so? Well, before I answer that, let me give you a little bit of an overview of an alternative explanation of this. And I'll begin with a quote from Richard Dawkins. Most of you probably have heard of him. There's the dragonfly nymph and a dragonfly. As you can see, they look quite different, and they are quite different. But here is from one of his books. Biology is the study of complicated living things that give the appearance of having been designed for a purpose. Now, who is Richard Dawkins? Well, he's an Englishman who has spent most of his life as an atheist who promotes atheism and the theory of evolution promoted by Charles Darwin. From 1859, his book Origin of Species, or The Preservation of Favored Races in the Struggle for Life. That was the original title, which has since been deleted. The Preservation of Favored Races in the Struggle for Life. That was the full title. You can guess why that was deleted from later volumes of his book. So now, does Richard Dawkins, famous atheist, does he believe that living things were designed for a purpose? Does he believe that? No, he does not believe that. But he admits that they appear to be designed for a purpose. This is his quote. But what he actually believes, like Darwin, Charles Darwin, is that random mutations over millions of years with no intelligence needed, no knowledge needed, no power needed, no information needed, no designer needed, he believes that incremental small variations produced by through the mechanism of mutations, produced all the living things on Earth, including dragonflies and you and me. That's what he believes. And there was no plan. Life simply progresses and diverses with no plan and no purpose. And before we proceed back through the lesson, I just want you to think about the implications of that one idea. Now, this is Richard Dawkins, a picture of Richard Dawkins. Many of you have seen him speak, probably, at least on videos. Richard Dawkins and much of the world who accepts the nature cult of Darwinism, just like you and I do, look in the mirror pretty much every morning. And when Richard Dawkins looks in the mirror in the morning, he sees two eyes staring back at him that he believes were not designed for seeing. He sees two ears on the sides of his head, symmetrical. You remember the four lessons I did on the vestibulo-ocular reflex system. Whether he knows anything about that, I kind of doubt. But just think about the fact he's getting ready for his morning, and the water in the sink is running. He hears that. The radio's in the kitchen going on, and he hears that. His wife is telling him what he needs to do after work, and he hears that all simultaneously. But these ears, in his opinion, were not designed for hearing. That's what he believes. He brushes his teeth, and he doesn't believe the teeth that he has were designed for chewing. The food that he ate for breakfast goes down to a stomach that he believes was not designed for digesting food. He's breathing with lungs that were not designed for breathing. He has a heart that is pumping blood, but it wasn't designed for pumping blood. Do you understand how stupid this is? I hope I'm making my case here. Some very intelligent and sometimes handsome, attractive people just, they don't get it. They don't see it. They have a blind spot that is bigger than the universe. And Richard Dawkins is one of those people. So there's an absurdity to this. There's an absurdity to this position that they put themselves in imagining a world without God. They are imagining a world without God, and because they are imagining that world, nothing makes sense. Nothing makes sense without God. The creation has no valid explanation without God. Here's what the Bible says about it. The fool has said in his heart, there is no God. The person who says that God doesn't exist, that person is a fool. You know why I know that? Because God said so. He's a fool. And there's lots of them. Millions, billions of fools who do not believe in the God of the Bible. Now, Charles Darwin developed this idea that life began and emerged from a warm little pond. That's his quote from The Origin of Species. A warm little pond. He believed life emerged and evolved from a warm little pond. And this was based on his observation of insects and amphibians, frogs, various things that he observed truly did emerge out of a warm little pond. So then why was he wrong? Why is that not right? Why is that not true? Well, I'm going to hold off answering that question until we've looked at a few more examples of this, these extraordinary changes, like a frog, for example. Now, how do you get a frog? I mean, not how do you catch one. How do you get one? I mean, how do they exist on Earth? How did they begin to exist on Earth? Well, again, a frog lives all their early life, like the dragonfly nymph, in the water. So, in the case of a frog or a toad, what you have first is a tadpole, or in this case, this is a picture, I'm pointing back there because the screen's back there, I should be pointing. This is called a polywog. You can say that if it's polywog. It's an interesting word. But a polywog is a bullfrog tadpole. I used to find them all the time when I lived at the lake. Tadpoles have a long fin, as you can see, a long tail that has fins on them, not unlike some fish. They have gills for breathing, somewhat like fish, and lots of other interesting things that frogs do not have. Frogs don't have a fin with its tail. Frogs don't have gills. And frogs don't, even though they live, they're amphibians, they live part of their life in water. They don't live exclusively in the water. So again, does or did the tadpole evolve into a frog? That's the question for you. Did the dragonfly nymph evolve into a dragonfly? Is that what happened? Well, in the case of the tadpole, the transition from one stage of life to the next, it almost magically seems to appear these legs on either side. So this is a tadpole turning into a frog. Magically, these legs just start to emerge out of its body. You know, it looks very much like the illustrations of evolutionists that show fish walking up on land and transitioning into reptiles, doesn't it? It looks very much like that. So why isn't this evolution? Think about that. Why isn't this evolution? I'm talking about in the Darwinian sense of evolution. Now, you could use the word evolution as far as macroevolution or microevolution. I'm talking about Darwinian evolution. We all understand that. Isn't the tadpole evolving, changing, transitioning, emerging, mutating, morphing from one kind of animal to another kind of animal? Is that what's happening here? Are these two different kinds of animals? Well, we're going to answer all these questions that I'm posing here. This is an illustration. You'll find lots of these on images. But this is an illustration of a lizard turning into a blue jay. Is that what happened? Is a lizard one kind of animal and a blue jay, a bird, another kind of animal? Yes. The answer is yes to that. There are two different kinds of animals. What about this? The evolution of a killer whale. So you've got a wolf-like creature. Look how goofy and stupid looking those transitional forms are, by the way. They're always like that. It's like trying to portray something between a monkey and a man. It's goofy and stupid looking. You know why? Because they were designed by humans, not by God. That's why they look that way. I'm a designer. These things are exclusive to me, but it's really obviously these are badly designed. But that's what evolutionists believe. They believe that a wolf began to feed in the water and eventually go into the water and then eventually became a whale. That's what they believe. Now, is a wolf and a whale two different kinds of animals? Yes. The answer to that is yes. There are two different kinds of animals. Now, is a monkey and a man two different kinds of creatures? The answer is yes. There are two different. There's no genetic relationship between monkeys and men. Okay. How do you get one of these? Now, this is a beetle. By the way, those words that you just saw up there, evolving, emerging, mutating, those are magic words. Those are the magic words of the evolutionist. And those magic words are intended to deceive and divert attention away from what you should be thinking about. I see this all the time. It evolved. It emerged. Life got a foothold. And here we are. Life got a foothold. Oh, yeah? Really? Let's see you demonstrate that in a laboratory. Demonstrate life getting a foothold in a warm little pond. Let's see that happen. the Miller-Urey experiment, I don't have time to get into this, but just briefly, in 1952, Miller and Urey, two scientists, got together, tried to create an experiment that they supposed was early Earth environment. And they put various chemicals, methane, water, ammonia. They subtracted all the oxygen because they knew that would oxidize and kill anything. But what they got out of the experiment was some brown goo, because that's what you get when you combine those materials. But they said that it was the proteins for life. And they thought that they were successful in showing that the proteins of life you could arrive at those through just combining the right material. Well, here we are, 2026. This experiment has been done thousands of times and with different elements, different materials off of the periodic table. And guess what? There's still no life. You cannot create life from non-life. It's never happened. Not once, not ever. That's the whole theory of evolution. Spontaneously generating creatures out of nothing, out of non-life. It's never happened. Not once, not ever. I thought, by the way, this science was predicated upon observation, that you observe things. I thought that was science, isn't it? Yes, it is. No one's ever observed life coming from non-life. So be aware of these magic words when you're listening to a nature program and they say this thing emerged, it's evolving, it's transitioning. Those are magic words. Now, let's get back to this guy. This is a large beetle, as you can see there. There's lots of other large beetles. That's a Goliath beetle, I believe, if I'm not mistaken. That's a rhinoceros beetle. Now, how do you get one of these? You can see they're quite large because they're in a man's hand there. So they're quite big beetles. I've got, I don't have one of those, but I do have some sizable beetles that Lindsay found for me some time back. So how do you get one of those again? Well, are they born just smaller versions of what you see there? No, they're not. This is what the Goliath beetle looks like before he's a Goliath beetle. What's that? Well, it's usually called a grub or a grub worm. And grub worms live in the dirt, under the dirt, and they eat under the dirt, and they live an extremely different life than the beetle that they become. So, again, these two creatures seem to be unrelated to one another, but they're the same creature, actually. So does the grub worm evolve into the stag beetle or the rhinoceros beetle in the Darwinian sense? Well, I'm going to solve all these problems, this conundrum, this dilemma for you briefly. But let me give you one more example. Butterflies. I did a whole lesson on butterflies a number of years ago. You were probably here, some of you were. How do you get one of these? Or one of these? That's a close-up of seeing the little scales on the butterfly's wings. There's about 7 million of them, if you count both sides of the wings on a large butterfly. That's a close-up of the scales of a butterfly that have a beautifully arranged scales like a mosaic that create a particular design related to that species. We have a butterfly bush out behind the house there beside our patio, and there's butterflies on it all through the season. They're just everywhere. So this has been happening a long time. So how do you get a butterfly? Do butterflies just start out as miniature versions of the adults? Is that how they get their start? No. In order to get a butterfly, you have to start with one of these. Actually, you have to go a little bit further back than that with an egg, but we'll start with this one. This one is actually a monarch butterfly caterpillar. So you have to start with one of those, or one of those, or one of those. So a caterpillar is kind of like an eating machine. It eats and eats and eats and eats leaves, specific leaves, by the way, until it gets really big. And then the caterpillar creates a special encasement or capsule, otherwise known as a chrysalis, or if you were a moth, it would be a cocoon. And what would happen would be that your entire body inside of that chrysalis would emulsify. Basically, you have a cellular breakdown of the material of the caterpillar, which becomes a gel-like substance. Clear, if you were to cut the chrysalis open at a certain stage, you wouldn't find anything in there other than some clear gel. Now, these are the raw materials for something completely different. An entirely new and different creature is remade, new eyes, new legs, new body, new wings, all come out of this clear gel. If we didn't know it happened and somebody told us about it, we wouldn't believe it. But it happens all the time. There's about 180,000 species, if you include moths, of butterflies and moths. And they're reproducing all the time this way. Now, did the caterpillar evolve into a butterfly? That's what I want to know. Or you could ask the questions a different way. Which came first, the caterpillar or the butterfly? Or which came first? That's a series illustration there of the monarch butterfly caterpillar creating its case. And here is the monarch butterfly then coming out of the case. So which came first? This is a trick question, by the way. But which came first, the caterpillar or the butterfly? Or which came first, the stag beetle or the grub worm? Or which came first, the tadpole or pollywog or the frog? Or which came first, the dragonfly nymph or the dragonfly? Trick question. It's kind of like this question, which came first, the chicken or the egg? You see, one of two things has to be true. You either have to have a chicken that was not hatched from an egg, or you have to have an egg that was not laid by a hen. One of those two things has to be true. Which one is it? The world wonders about this all the time. We don't. I don't. Because I know the truth. And you do too. But don't get ahead of me. Now let's get to the answers. The answers to all these questions are fairly simple, actually. Let me ask you this. That's a dragonfly nymph. Does a dragonfly nymph start to feel amorous and romantic and get together with another dragonfly nymph, and they both reproduce, they mate, and they reproduce a dragonfly nymph? Is that what happens? Or here's another one. What about this? Does a polywog and another polywog feel polyamorous, I guess, and they mate, and you get another polywog? Is that what happens? That was intended to be funny, so I'm glad some people are laughing. Is that what happens? What about, do two grubworms feel romantic and mate? They get married, and they produce another grubworm. Is that what happens? No. The answer to that is no. No in every case. So, this is what I want to know from the evolutionist. For millions and millions of years, were the grubworms mating and producing more grubworms? That's what I want to know. Ask one sometime. See what they say about that. Well, no. The answer is no. Do you know why the answer is no? Because the grubworm, I'll back up a minute, the grubworm has no sexual organs. The polywog, or the tadpole, has no sexual organs. They do not mate. They can't. In fact, there's nothing in them that tells them that they are either male or female. The dragonfly nymph has no sexual organs. They do not reproduce. So, what's the answer to all this? Well, here's the simple answer. The answer is that the only form of each of these creatures that are truly male and female is the adult form. So which came first? Which came first? In the beginning, which had to come first? It was the adult male and female of every single species on earth. Why do I know that? Not just because the Bible tells me that. I agree with the Bible. God knows what He's talking about. He declares what is true. But another reason that I know that is because there's no other way to get them. Unless you have the adult male and female, you're never going to get babies. Now, what this means is this, that all of the genetic information has to be, for every stage of life, has to be in the fertilized egg. All of it. And this is true for every animal on earth. All of the information, there's some extremely small ones that are produced, that divide, it's asexual. Okay, I understand that. But for the vast majority of creatures on earth, they reproduce sexually. And all of the genetic information has to be in there from the beginning for every stage. So you see, two grubworms can't mate because they don't have any sexual organs. They don't know they're boy or girl. Now, I wanted to talk just a second about this. Let me see. Here's a point. I'll get to this in a moment. Let's go back a second. Have you ever thought about the fact, and this is a fact, that nearly every creature on earth, including you and me, are born with one half of a sexual reproduction system? We are born with one half of one, which is no good functionally to produce an offspring unless you have the other half. This is true for all of creation. We are all born with one half of a sexual reproduction system. Isn't that amazing? We're either boys or girls, male or female. Interesting that Jesus in Mark 10 and in Matthew 19 cited this one part of Genesis 1 when he said, from the beginning of creation, God made them male and female. Remember that? God made them male and female from the beginning. That's not just what Jesus said. That's what has to be true. There is no other way to, and every species, every kind of animal on earth is 100% proof that that is the case. That God began every single kind of animal with a male and a female from the beginning because there is no other way. Now, I wanted to talk a moment about proof because you have been taught that proof is only applicable in mathematics. That you can't prove anything except in the realm of mathematics. And the people who teach an uncertain and ambiguous relativistic worldview are themselves ignorant of the absolute truths of God. And therefore, they want you to join them in their uncertainty in the world, in their world of individual opinions and relativistic truths, where I can have my truth and you can have your truth and our truths can be totally different. That's their world. And in that world, it's true. You can't prove anything. And it's like when I said with Richard Dawkins, nothing makes sense without God. You just run in circles. God is right, and everybody else is just guessing. The Bible says that in the Christ resurrection, he said there were many infallible proofs. Do you believe that? I believe that. That the resurrection is provable. And there were many infallible proofs related to that. I believe the Bible and not man. And we need to let God be true and every man a liar. Supposedly intelligent men claim through mathematical formulas that the universe began from nothing and then there was a big bang, nothing exploded and became the universe. And they say, we've got the numbers right here to prove it. Do you believe that? Is mathematics really proof that that's true? No, of course not. Again, let me see that in observational science. Wouldn't our energy problems be solved if we could get a sun from nothing? Of course, it's a lie. Don't fall for it. Don't listen to fools who have rejected God and are trying in every way possible to convince you to do the same, to reject God. Don't follow fools, lest you follow them to hell. Follow wise men. Follow wise women who are following Jesus to heaven. That's where we want to go. There you go. In about 30 minutes, well, maybe a little bit more than that. Okay, 40, 50. 50 minutes, I have destroyed evolution. Les has destroyed evolution in 50 minutes. Now, it's not because Les is so smart. It's because God is right. God is right. And his creation proclaims and declares that he is right. Can you see that? I hope so. There's so much more that I could say and has been said, but evolution is based on ignorance and imagination. Creation, just like Genesis 1, is based on knowledge and facts. We have knowledge and facts. They have ignorance and imagination. We have knowledge and facts on our side if you're a creationist. Well, I need to close here. By the way, this principle that I have, that the creatures that we've explored and observed in this lesson are sort of exaggerated in their stages of life. But have you ever thought about the fact that even we have our own kind of metamorphosis? We lived in a water world for 9 months. How was the first baby born without a placenta? How was the first baby born without a yolk sac? How was the first baby born without an umbilical cord? You see, I did a whole lesson on this a number of years ago. The heart of the baby, the direction of the blood flow actually changes at birth. Did you know that? There are cellular welds within the valves of the heart that permanently weld closed. And the direction of the blood changes. You know, there's another kind of metamorphosis that we can participate in besides the one that we already have. And that's this one right here. This is from Romans 12 and verse 2. And do not be conformed to this world, but be transformed. You know what that Greek word is? Metamorphosed. Transformed. Be transformed, metamorphosed by, that's the Greek word, by the renewing of your mind, that you may prove what is good and acceptable and the perfect will of God. That's something that we can all do, not just once, but every day. We want to be renewing, metamorphosing, transitioning our mind into the likeness of Christ. And you know what? If you're a Christian, we're going to have another metamorphosis at the end of days, and it's called the resurrection, where our bodies will be changed in a moment, in a twinkling of an eye. We're going to leave this old flesh and blood, these bones, these things that wear out, and we're going to be metamorphosed into a resurrection body that is described in 1 Corinthians 15, that is going to be glorious. Aren't you looking forward to that? I am, and I hope you are. If we can help you in any way today to come closer to the Lord, then we would love to do that. Thank you for your patience. I know I've been nearly an hour, but didn't it go fast? Thank you very much. Jesse's got one more song to sing here.